Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, text number 13. So since we haven't got it written down, I'll just say the verse. Dehi nosmin yatha dehe komaram yovanam jara tatha dehantara praptir diras tatra na muyati. Please repeat after me. Dehina. Of the embodied. Asmin. In this. Yatha. As. Dehe. In the body. Komaram. Boyhood. Yovanam. Youth. Jara. Old age. Tatha. Similarly. Deha antara. Of transference of the body. Praptihi. Achievement. Dhiraha. The sober. The sober. Tatra. Thereupon. Na. Never. Muyati. Is deluded. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Please repeat after me. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body, from boyhood to youth, to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Since every living entity is an individual soul, each is changing his body every moment, manifesting sometimes as a child, sometimes as a youth, and sometimes as an old man. Yet the same spirit soul is there and does not undergo any change. This individual soul finally changes the body at death and transmigrates to another body. And since it is sure to have another body in the next birth, either material or spiritual, there was no cause for lamentation by Arjuna on the account of death, neither for Bhishma nor for Drona, for whom he was so much concerned. Rather, he should rejoice for their changing bodies from old to new ones, thereby rejuvenating their energy. Such changes of body account for varieties of enjoyment or suffering, according to one's work in life. So Bhishma and Drona, being noble souls, were surely going to have spiritual bodies in the next life, or at least life in heavenly bodies for superior enjoyment of material existence. So in either case, there was no cause of lamentation. Any man who has perfect knowledge of the constitution of the individual soul, the super soul, and nature, both material and spiritual, is called a dhira, or a most sober man. Such a man is never deluded by the change of bodies. The Maya body theory of oneness of spirit soul cannot be entertained, on the ground that the spirit soul cannot be cut into pieces as a fragmental portion. Such cutting into different individual souls would make the Supreme cleavable or changeable against the principle of the Supreme Being being unchangeable. As confirmed in the Gita, the fragmental portions of the Supreme exist eternally, sanatana, and are called kshara. That is, they have a tendency to fall down into material nature. These fragmental portions are eternally so, And even after liberation, the individual soul remains the same, fragmental. But once liberated, he lives an eternal life in bliss and knowledge with the personality of Godhead. The theory of reflection can be applied to the super soul, who is present in each and every individual body and is known as the Paramatma. He is different from the individual living entity. When the sky is reflected in water, the reflections represent both the sun and the moon and the stars also. The stars can be compared to the living entities, and the sun or the moon to the Supreme Lord. The fragmental spirit soul is represented by Arjuna, and the Supreme Soul is the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. They are not on the same level, as will be apparent in the beginning of the fourth chapter. If Arjuna is on the same level with Krishna, and Krishna is not superior to Arjuna, then their relationship of instructor and instructed becomes meaningless. If both of them are deluded by the illusory energy Maya, then there is no need of one being the instructor and the other being instructed. Such instruction would be useless because in the clutches of Maya, no one can be an authoritative instructor. Under the circumstances, it is admitted that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Lord, superior in position to the living entity, Arjuna, who is a forgotten soul deluded by Maya. Omagyana Timarandasya Genanjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitemina Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha. I was born into the darkest of ignorance, but my spiritual master opened my eyes with a touch of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. So this verse of the Bhagavad Gita explains, it's a very elementary principle in Vedic understanding. But you'll find that in the modern worldview, which of course one could say that there's two predominant worldviews which have always existed, not just today, but always. So one is a spiritual worldview, which is a God-centered worldview, and the other is a materialistic worldview, which goes by various names: humanism, materialism, rationalism, postmodernism, so many different names for the same thing. But it's basically materialism and atheism. So in the atheistic worldview, there is no God. We are the center of everything. Everything is relative. And we are the measure of everything. The individual is the measure of everything. Everything is according to our likings, dislikings. Because we are the center of the universe. That is why we came to this world. Because out of envy of God. So because of this madness, we thought that we could be God. We can envious of God. So since this doesn't quite, it's not the proper move in the spiritual world, so God, Krishna being very kind, so you have this desire to be God, so I will send you to a place where you can live out your desire. We all have these desires. So you can live out this desire of being God. So that's the material world. The only problem with that is that everybody else in the material world also thinks they're God. So there's a big problem, you know? Because they're fighting, I'm God, no, you're God. You know, but they, of course, nobody says that they're God. They just act that way. Nobody really, if you were to say that you were God, then the men with the white suits would come. Or unless you lived in Whitefield. Then that's a different... then they might give you a donation. But God is not so ugly. So that's the materialistic worldview. But in the spiritual worldview, you know, Krishna's Vedic worldview, or even other legitimate, authentic spiritual traditions, God is at the center. Right? That is the difference. God is at the center. We say others, because there are other legitimate spiritual traditions, but the Krishna's Vedic culture, it is the oldest tradition. It is eternal. Other spiritual paths, which may be that they came into being at a certain time. Islam, they can date, you know, Christianity, they came in, they're teaching the same message, but they came into being at a certain time and place like that. But they're teaching eternal wisdom also. So you can, in one sense, say it is Veda, it is knowledge of God. Because that is the literal meaning of Veda, means knowledge. Or the supreme knowledge is Vedanta, the conclusion of all knowledge. And so, the God-conscious worldview has God at the center, instead of the individual living entity. Right? So with God at the center, we try to do everything in such a way that it fulfills the goal of life, which is to leave this material world. The reason we want to leave the material world is because it's messy. It's not a nice place. You know, no matter where you are, whether you're in India or in Swarga, otherwise known as the United States, everybody thinks they all want to go there by various methodologies. You know, studying for so many years in IIT, then they can qualify to go to, you know, their austerity. They think that's the place to go. But it's not nice there either. They may have various external material facility. There's a gross and subtle body. So the material comforts of the gross body may be satisfied, but their subtle body is very unhappy, signified by the fact that very high divorce rates, you know, everybody's got their psychiatrist, so many relationship problems. So they may have physical comforts, but their emotional life is finished. This is completely dissatisfactory. Whereas you can be poor and still be happy. But they have proven you can be rich and unhappy. Rich and unhappy people. Now, one time I read some survey done by the United Nations. They were surveying the happiest countries in the world. Right? The happiest country. And the top number one spot was Bangladesh. I think India was like in the top five. So they have nothing, but they are all very pious people. They all believe in God, so they're very happy. They're satisfied in their life. Whereas places like America and UK, they were at about the halfway point, like number 50 and 45 or something like that. Well, they at least had material. They at least had material comfort. Whereas places like the former Soviet Union, they were right at the very bottom. They had neither spiritual or material. They're just, you know, they're like zeros, you know. Neither material, neither spiritual satisfaction or material. So that's the situation if one just pursues a materialistic, because the former Soviet bloc was the ultimate in, communism is the ultimate in materialism. You know, they call it dialectical materialism. We're having a little bit of a communication problem here. Dialectical materialism, I mean, they're extremely materialistic. In fact, this one, the verse here about how the soul is not the body, once I read a commentation about why the communists specifically push the point of atheism. Because if you can convince a person that there's no God, that they are the body, then you can control them. Because you can hurt the body. you can terrorize the body. You can do unpleasant things to the body and therefore force people into submission. But if a person believes in God, if they think that there's something other than the body, they're dangerous. Because they might do, if they have a higher principle, they may be prepared to sacrifice even their body. These are dangerous people. That's why they considered the Hari. Remember when I was living in Bangalore in 82, there was an article in the Hindu newspaper saying that the KGB, because like still at the height of the Cold War, 1982, before Brezhnev died, which was the end, the beginning of the single, the end of the Soviet era, the death of Brezhnev in November of 82. So the Pravda said that the two greatest threats to the Soviet Union were the Hare Krishna movement and rock and roll music. Now, if they only heard Hare Krishna rock and roll music, then that would be the, you know. But because it taught spiritual culture, and this frightened them, because it was because no matter what they do, even to the, they arrested devotees, they would put them in insane asylums, because the Russian, the communists use psychiatric methods of torture. They would, you know, if you believed in God, obviously you were crazy. Only insane people believed in God. So they would put you in psychiatric establishments, and then they would torture you. They would give you, they'd do some very nasty things. If you have a headache, you go to a doctor, they give you painkillers. The Russian, the communists devised drugs that would give you pain. So they would inject you with this drug, and your whole body, every cubic centimeter, would be writhing in agony. And when the dose was over, they give you another dose. Until you realize that, you know, you should give up your belief. That was their methodology. So they would arrest people. And they would do this to devotees also in Russia. Some very, very terrible things. Because they were afraid. These people were not going to be suppressed. Devotees did so many things in Russia. You know, they're out of fearlessness, completely fearlessness, because they knew they're not the body. So this is one of the elementary teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. The very beginning, it's only the second chapter. One of the first instructions that Krishna gives to Arjuna. You're not the body. He begins to explain the whole process of reincarnation. Now if you go to some other spiritual traditions, you might get vague references to the fact that the soul is different from the body, but nothing very explicit, and maybe only some scholars might understand it, or after studying it for deeply, you might get this idea that you're different from your body. But right here in the first chapter, or in the second chapter of the Gita, Krishna is immediately telling you, you're not the body, you're the soul, you're different. The body transmigrates. This is just the very beginning. So many, there's 16 more chapters to go. And the Gita is only, and it is the essence of Vedic knowledge. It is called the Gita Upanishad, the essence. Only in 700 verses, the essence is there. Much more is explained in graduate study, like the Srimad Bhagavatam, and then the Chaitanya Charitamrita, postgraduate studies of the science of God. How to become self-realized. But all is begins with the Bhagavad Gita. Because the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita, first of all, it gives us knowledge. The Bhagavad Gita gives us knowledge of five main subjects. The five main subjects of the Bhagavad Gita, the five subjects, not names, there's only five subjects of the Bhagavad Gita. The first is God, Krishna. The second is the soul, the Atman. The Jivatma, Paramatma, Jivatma. Then, material energy, Maya. Then, Kala Shakti, time. And then, Karma. The first four are eternal. The fifth is not. And once we can get rid of that, then we are released from material bondage. And by knowing this knowledge, then we become free from doubts. There's another purpose of the Bhagavad Gita, is to free one from all doubts. Because unless, you know, that is why Arjuna himself says to Krishna, except for you, no one can destroy the demons of doubt. These doubts which plague the mind. Yeah? People, I was just reading yesterday about postmodern philosophers, existentialists, they're just completely speculating. They have doubts upon their doubts. They're just like dogs chasing their tail. They have no conclusions. They can't make any. They say everything is relative, which is in itself an absolute statement. All their statements are full of contradictions because they don't want to believe in God. Their psychological makeup is that way. So they'll say everything is relative, which is an absolute statement, not a relative statement. So because their minds are full of doubts, they may claim to be saying that they want to find the truth, but in actuality they don't want to find the truth, because if they were to meet the truth, they would then have to obey the truth, and that's something that they don't want to do. That means if you come face to face with the absolute truth, you then have to surrender, but they don't want to do that. So, but for those who do want to find God, then the Bhagavad Gita removes all doubts. And when after all those doubts are removed, then you can go on to the Srimad Bhagavatam and other literature. And then also the Bhagavad Gita it gives us solace. Everybody has got various problems. The Bhagavad Gita was spoken at a time when Arjuna was in the greatest tribulation. He was a great, foremost warrior. Before the battle of Kurukshetra, he went, he was sent by Yudhishthir to do severe tapasya in order to gain celestial weapons. And he had, he got from Lord Shiva, his great weapons. And then he got from the Lokapalas, he got all their various weapons. Right, then he was living with Indra for approximately 5 years in Indraloka. So he was nobody could beat Arjuna. He was the greatest warrior. But here at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, he doesn't want to fight because he is in great distress. Because, though he likes to fight, it's his duty to fight. He's a Kshatriya. But he finds that it's not a perfect situation. Right? It's like everybody, we have to perform our duty, and we respect people who do their duty, because mostly their duty has to be done in situations which are not ideal. But then when we see that even the situation is not ideal, they still did their duty. So in Arjuna's case, he has to fight against his grandfather and his guru, who he loves dearly. He loves them. He has so much gratitude, and yet now he has to kill them. He has to ask them, how can I kill you? Right? At the beginning of the battle, he has to ask them, how do I kill you? So what's such a, so sometimes we think our life is not ideal. Let's think of Arjuna. He had to do so many difficulties. So similarly later when Arjuna, getting instructed in the Bhagavad Gita, all his illusion was dispelled. And then later, after the battle of Kurukshetra, as explained in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, when he found out that Krishna left the planet, when he comes back to Dwarka, and Yudhisthira can see something is very wrong, Arjuna is completely upset. There's so many bad omens, horrible omens. The murtis are sweating blood, and the jackals are howling, and the donkeys are braying, and blood is falling out of the sky. So many terrible omens. And he's asking them. He's asking Arjuna, what's wrong? What's wrong? And he's asking so many questions, and Arjuna is just not saying anything. And finally, he asks the most terrible question. And then Arjuna replies that Krishna is gone. And Arjuna, everybody is devastated. But then Arjuna, by remembering the previous instructions of Krishna on the battlefield, he regained composure. He again became happy. He again, became equipoised like he was before. In which case, Vyasadeva is extolling, he's highly glorifying the virtues of the Bhagavad Gita. So the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva is glorifying the Bhagavad Gita, that because Arjuna remembers all the instructions which he got in the Bhagavad Gita, he regained his, basically he regained his sanity, because he was lamenting, so much terrible lamentation. Just recently, a friend of mine in Mayapur, he had a great tragedy took place a couple of weeks ago. There was some severe flooding in Bengal. So you can imagine if you were to lose your spouse, she drowned in the flood. So that would be a terrible loss. But not only did he lose his wife, he lost his daughter and his brother all at once. So it was a great tragedy. I mean, he was completely devastated, totally devastated. But you know, because of association with devotees, and he was, you know, reading to him from the Bhagavad Gita, different things, he's been able to recover, you know, tremendously, and he's doing a lot better now. But such one of those losses would have been enough to greatly shake anyone. Even Arjuna in the battle of Kurukshetra, when Abhimanyu was killed, he became very disturbed. It's natural. You know, it's natural. The soul, we know that the soul doesn't die, but what we're lamenting is that now we don't have the association with that person who we were attached to. So our lamentation is not for the person who died, it's our lamentation for the fact that we don't have them anymore. We're crying for ourselves, because we haven't got that person for our happiness anymore. That, you know, those persons, they're gone somewhere else. They're enjoying, or they're, you know, it's like Krishna says in the Gita here, that why should Arjuna be unhappy when these two great souls die? That either they'll go back to God, or they'll go to Swarga. They'll get a new body. Just like in this room, we have some people who they're old, and in a not too distant future, they'll be changing their bodies. And we have some who are a little bit younger, who only a couple of years ago were somebody else, weren't they? We heard them. There's one over there. 2 or 3 years ago, they were somebody else, isn't it? Mataji? How old is your baby?
1 year.
So that means about 2 years ago, they were somebody else. 2 years ago, that was somebody else. Right, so there's somebody around, there's some people here who will be also transforming. So this knowledge is given in the Gita. So once we know, then this is not just for the Hindus. Srila Prabhupada Guru Maharaj once was preaching in, he was discussing at a university with all the professors, and the topic of science and religion came up. So he actually quoted this verse, and they were saying, oh, this is the realm of religion. He says, no. Only Hindus grow old? This is only applicable to Hindus? Muslims, this doesn't happen to Muslims? They don't go from babies to youth? This is applicable to everybody. Therefore, it's science. It's a science of God. So this is not only that Chinese people, you know, or Indian people. It's for everybody. Everybody will go through this process. They go from childhood to boyhood to youth to old age. And then there's ultimately death and transformation. This is applicable to everyone. That is why, and on that basis, Srila Prabhupada said, this is a science. Other systems, they were presented according to the audience. Right? According to the audience. So, at that time, throughout history, Bharatvarsha was always seen as a place of great knowledge. Right? Even in the ancient Greeks, the Romans, everybody viewed India as a place of great wisdom. If you read the biographies of philosophers like Pythagoras or Empedocles or this, you know, so many of them, even if they didn't go, the biographer will say he went to India and studied. Because it was like saying he went to Harvard. It was such a, you know, even though he didn't go, the biographer said he went, because it was like giving him some credit. Because India was seen as a place of great learning. Right? There was one very famous philosopher, his name was Apollonius of Tyana. So he actually walked to India. He walked to India because he was a contemporary of Emperor Nerva and Emperor Domitian. He was actually a contemporary of Christ. But he wanted to get... he was a Naishtika Brahmachari, and he was a teetotaler, vegetarian, but he was very much into learning about prophecy, how to be a prophet, how to prophesize, tell the future. So he wanted to learn different techniques. So he wanted to go find the highest technique. So he went to the Magi of Babylon. He walked there, and they said, well, we can teach you something, but if you really want to learn, then you have to go to India. He walked to India. And there's so many things. You can read it about this book. He was... Anyway, it's a long story. I don't want to get into that. The main point being that the Center for Spiritual Technology was India. Just like today, the Center for Material Technology is, you know, Japan, U.S., right? You may have other places. You may go to the Amazon basin and find somebody with a digital camera, but it wasn't produced there. They have some technology, but the heart is a U.S. or Japan or something, made in China. Well, similarly, you'll find spiritual knowledge in other places, but not up to the standard, because it depends upon the consumer abilities. Like, you know, the ability for the consumer to buy, that's the kind of technology they get. So the ability of the consumer to understand the knowledge, that is the amount of knowledge which they're given. So in the place where, you know, places like where Jesus was preaching, they couldn't absorb so much. Even him, he says himself in the Bible, I have much more to teach, but you cannot bear to hear it. And for the little bit that he did teach, they didn't appreciate so much. And what to speak of Muhammad, he was preaching to people, he had to tell them, you don't sleep with your mother, you don't do so many different things, because, you know, he's just teaching basically sub-religious principles, morality, you know, which brings a person up to sattva guna. But right in the beginning, Arjuna is already, he's an Aryan. And Krishna's chastising him, why are you behaving like a non-Aryan? Aryan doesn't mean what color your skin is or what language you speak, but Aryan means someone who's God-conscious. So why are you behaving like somebody who's not doing his prescribed duty for God? That was Arjuna. He wanted to give up his prescribed duty, which is avachatriya. So that means Arjuna is a suitable student for Krishna's message because he comes from a highly spiritual advanced society, because, you know, this is Vedic culture. Krishna's Vedic culture is a God-oriented culture, God-centered culture. The whole purpose of Vedic culture, Vedic civilization, is to uplift the soul and to ultimately leave the world. And even if a person, you know, it's designed for every type of person. Everybody can fit into Krishna's Vedic society. Otherwise, they have demigod worshippers, you have people who worship, they want to go to Swarga, you know, they do their karma kandis. But they understand that there's something better than living in this material world. They know that they should go up. You know, they go to Swarga, go to Janaloka, Tapaloka, Siddhaloka, so many different lokas, better than this place. Because this place is Dukalayan Mashashma, a temporary place full of misery. So maybe they don't know that they should leave and go back to Godhead, go back to Vaikuntha, but at least they know that this is not where they should be, that there's something better than this. So the idea is that we should leave this place, you know. And eventually, as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, when all their punya uses up, they come back down to here. So the whole focus is that somehow or other, if you plug into Krishna's Vedic culture, then the tide of the culture pulls you back to Krishna. You know, it may not be in one lifetime, it may take several lifetimes. Bahu janmanam ante gnanavan mam prapadyate vasudevam sarvamiti samahatma sudulabha. At the conclusion of many, many lifetimes, that person who has acquired knowledge, what does he understand? That Vasudev is all that there is. And such a great soul is hard to find. So it's a long-term process. You can go very quickly, or you can go very slowly. It's your choice. But you will advance, if you stick in Krishna's culture. So that is a choice that we all have to make, whether we want to follow Krishna or not follow Krishna. We have to make that choice individually. It was by our choice that we decided to come here, and it's by our choice that we can get out. That is why Krishna explains in the sixth chapter that our worst enemy is our mind. But the mind is also our best friend, if we can control it. So if we can control our mind, it becomes our best friend, because then we can control it, so that we always desire to be hearing about Krishna, serving Krishna, so many different ways, reading scriptures, as Krishna says in the last chapter of the 18th chapter of the Gita. Simply by reading the Bhagavad Gita, the person worships me with his intelligence. So there's so many different ways of serving Krishna. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Pada Sevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. So, by hearing about Krishna, Parikshit achieved perfection. Because he heard the Srimad Bhagavatam. Simply by speaking, Sukadev achieved perfection. By remembering Vishnu Smarana, by remembering Krishna, Prahlad, he achieved perfection. By worshipping the lotus feet, serving the lotus feet of the Lord, Lakshmi Devi achieved perfection, Pada Sevana. By Dasyam, by service, Hanuman, he achieved perfection. By Vandana, by offering prayers, Akrura, he achieved perfection. Archanam, by worshipping, temple worship, Prithu Maharaj, he achieved perfection. Sakya, by being the friend, Arjuna, he achieved perfection. And by offering everything, Atmanivedanam, Bali, he achieved perfection. So if we could do one of these items, or more, or a combination, or all of them, like Ambarish Maharaj, he did all of them, we can perfect our life. Either totally in one shot, or at least something. We can make, because as explained later in this chapter, that there's no loss or diminution. Even if we only achieve 1% in this lifetime, in the next life, we begin at 2%. There's no loss. But even if you're the owner of Infosys, when you die, in your next lifetime, you're just a programmer. Or worse. you don't come into the next life owning a company. Unless you did some great punya, unless you did some great spiritual thing, then you might. It's like my friend, Ambarish, Alfred Ford. He was born. When he was born, they put $20 million in his bank account. They opened a bank account while they were still changing his diapers, and he had $20 million immediately. That's because of some previous punya he had, some previous work he did. So, but unless a person has some punya, then when you leave, you have nothing. It's like somebody like Stalin. Everybody heard of Stalin. So when he controlled all of Russia, everything was at his disposal, every beautiful woman, all the money. But he also was an extremely sinful person, murdered, the cause of murder, of death of millions of people. So, and he was an atheist. Like he asked one time, they said that the Pope said something about the Pope. He says, and how many divisions does the Pope have? Because he only judged strength by military strength. So he asked, how many divisions does the Pope have? So when he died, he's just going to hell his next lifetime. he can't take any of that with him. All he takes with him is the sinful reactions of all his activities. The murder of tens of millions of people. So in the present age that we're in Kali Yuga, Krishna explains so many various methods of yoga, methods of purification. And Krishna comes in different avatars at different times, as he explains in the, I think it's the fourth chapter, that whenever there is a diminution in Dharma and a rise in Adharma, then he comes himself or he sends a representative. Right? So in this instance, he came himself. In Dwapara Yuga, he came himself. In the Kali Yuga, which we're presently in, he comes in various forms. One form is the literary incarnation, is the Srimad Bhagavatam. He comes in the Nama Rupa, the holy name. And the holy name in particular because he came in the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Yuga avatar, who has propagated the chanting of the holy name. That's why we take cognizance of the Nama Rupa, of Krishna coming in his form as the holy name, because the Krishna is complete, is absolute, is the absolute truth. So the Supreme Absolute, that means there's no distinction between his name, his form, his activities, his associates, his pastimes, his clothing, everything is absolute. That means Krishna's name and Krishna is the same. We may not perceive it. We may not be able to perceive that now. Just as a person who is sick, right? You may be very sick. So when the doctor gives you medicine, you may not be able to understand the the biochemical reaction in your body and how everything is happening. But over the course of time, as you take the medicine, you become better. You become cured. So similarly, by being in association with the holy name of Krishna, by chanting it, by hearing it, we regain our original consciousness without any, it's not an imposition on the mind or an imposition on the intelligence. We just simply have to hear the name and chant the name, and then we regain our consciousness. Just like if someone is asleep, so by calling their name, they begin to, they were in a very deep slumber, they were dreaming that they were in Acapulco, having a suntan or whatever, drinking a piña colada of the rum. And all of a sudden, then they hear somebody's calling their name. They wake up. So that is the process of spiritual realization, is actually waking up. Lord Chaitanya Bhaktivinoda Thakur has one song where Lord Chaitanya sings, Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago, Gora Chandra Bole. Lord Chaitanya is asked to wake up sleeping souls, wake up. So this, why are you sleeping in the lip and in the lap of the witch called Maya? So we're all sleeping in Maya. This illusion, this Maya, is actually this material consciousness is sleeping, a deep sleep. But there is another, just as we dream, why do we dream? Krishna explains to Uddhav in the Uddhava Gita in the 11th canto that there's a reason why we dream. It's not by accident. It's not, everything in Krishna's creation has a purpose. If you see everything from the God-centered worldview. So Krishna explains why he created dreaming. He created dreaming so that a sober person, a thoughtful man will think, or woman will think, it seems so real, that dream. It seems so real, but now I can see that wasn't real, it was a dream. And then they might extrapolate, and this also seems so real. this waking state I'm in. It also seems so real. But maybe it also, it's not real. So a thoughtful person will begin to think that from, you know, seeing the example of how a dream turned out not to be real, though, you know, it, in one sense, it actually is real in the sense that you experience it. You know, you, people can die in dreams just from out of fear. Or if they embrace the opposite sex, they can experience, you know, have a sexual experience because it's real. But it's not a shared reality. Explained in the Vedanta, it's not a shared reality. Only you are sharing. Only you are experiencing that dream. And the dream state is a conglomeration of recollections of former lives. Because they're all stored in the mind. The mind remembers, keeps everything in there. But the mind is there from millions and millions of lifetimes. So there's so many memories are there. So that's why when you dream, sometimes they seem very strange. It's like a khichdi. Everything mixed together from 25,000 lifetimes, you know, everything, so many different memories. And so they seem very odd. They all happened, but they're all stuck together in strange ways. So a person will think, that seems so real, and it seems so logical while you were, when it was going through, but then later you think, that was a very strange dream. you know, because it seemed, but at the time it seemed like a very logical thing. So a thoughtful person would think that this, you know, it seems surreal. So this also seems real, but, you know, so he begins to inquire. So we can be wakened up from this state by the process of chanting the holy name. So that's why we do kirtan, and that's a congregational chanting of the holy name. That is why we are here. We've been, it purifies the consciousness. It makes one capable of understanding philosophical discourse, and also practicing of japa. So these are the methods which are recommended for the present age of Kali, because we have so many disqualifications. The Kali Yuga is an ocean of disqualifications. The only beneficial thing about the Kali Yuga is that one can make great spiritual advancement very quickly through the chanting of the holy name. That is the only dispensation, the only beneficial, the only good quality, the only of the Kali Yuga is, if a person is fortunate, then they can begin this process of chanting. As Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Brahmanda Konya Bhagyavan Jiva Guru Krishna Prasadi Pai Bhakti Latabija. That the living entity is going from one Brahmanda to the next Brahmanda. We speak about here of reincarnation from one body to the next body. But there he's talking about from one Brahmanda to the next Brahmanda. Brahmanda refers to the universe. And the universe is the duration of one life of Lord Brahma. So the one life of Lord Brahma, for him is only 100 years. For us, in our years, is 311 trillion and 40 billion years. So you could go through human years. That's not dog years. That's not amoeba years, you know. And during, while we've had this conversation, so many amoebas, you know, have come and gone. They went through generations. So that would be, you know, unfathomable number of lifetimes which you could go through. And the jiva is going from one Brahmanda to the next. Millions, you know. One time, Lord Chaitanya explained that this universe is just like one mustard seed in a barrel of mustard seeds. So going from, and how many, it's one mustard seed, one universe to the next. We have to go through that cycle of birth and death. But he says if he is Bhagyavanja, if he is a fortunate living entity. So what does it mean? Srila Prabhupada explained, what does it mean to be a fortunate living entity? So my Guru Maharaj says, fortunate living entity means someone who is sincere. Someone who is actually sincere to find out about God. Then Krishna sends them a guru. And that guru plants in their heart the bhakti lata, the seed, the bhakti lata, which is the seed of the creeper of devotion, And then they can understand God. Then they will understand God. So the process in this age is by chanting the holy name. So that's why we have these programs to introduce people in the process of chanting the holy name, either first congregationally and also individually through the process of japa. So I'll end here, and if anybody has any questions or comments, I should also invite those of you who are newcomers to please take part in this movement. My spiritual master went to great lengths and sacrifices to inaugurate this movement. So he always would encourage everyone, young and old, young, to participate in this Sankirtan movement of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and their life will become sublime. He didn't hear the previous announcement. So, any questions? Looks like there's no questions. Okay, so then we have to ask the host, what is next? Okay. That's correct. That's why. All right. So then, who will lead the kirtan for the aarti? Where is Ananda? Please lead the kirtan for the aarti.
Yeah.